This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The president needs a shrink. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what we have for you this hour.
The leader of the free world has a physician assigned to him, but given the magnitude of the job, Alex Thompson at Politico says anybody in the Oval Office should also have a psychiatrist.
The VA admits its role in creating a large population of opioid-addicted veterans by over-prescribing painkillers. Hear how the agency is now struggling to reverse the damage.
Touching story of how a cancer survivor is making T-shirts to lift the spirits of those in hospitals battling the disease.
And throwing in the towel with standard operating systems and choosing something open source instead, like Linux.
This is not something for the faint of heart. You need to back up your systems if you do this, and you need to have some gadget know-how before you try it. But it's really got a lot of potential, and I think in a couple of years, we might see more people moving toward these open source, they don't cost anything, operating systems.
Consumer advocate Chris Elliott on changing your operating system, if you dare. He's here later in the hour. One of the most stressful and consequential offices in human history, the President of the United States ought to have easy access to the best medical care available, including when it comes to mental health. Alex Thompson, contributing writer to Politico, says the newly sworn-in Congress now has a chance to strengthen the health of all future presidents by appointing a psychiatrist from the military to work alongside the presidential physician. Alex, make the case.
Well, you just have to look at the history. So, you know, when they first started a presidential physician, it was right after that President Wilson had a debilitating stroke in office, and then President Harding died in office, and then they created a presidential physician. And now, you know, as medical reports and leaks kind of come through history, we now know that a bunch of presidents felt that they needed psychiatric medication, and maybe a few actually could have used some psychiatric medication when they were in office. And so, you know, I argued that Congress should follow suit and make the best mental health professional available to the president at all times, in the same way they did for the presidential physician.
Well, you mentioned Kennedy, Nixon, Johnson, even Lincoln. What was up with those guys?
Well, so Lincoln is interesting in that, you know, he had such periods of depression, such periods of debilitating depression that he would miss work, he would be bedridden, he would contemplate suicide. There's even some anonymous poems, which we are pretty sure that were all about suicide, that he wrote. And he even tried the 19th century equivalent of an antidepressant, but unfortunately it was just mercury and rose water. When it comes to Kennedy, you know, he had such periods of debilitating anxiety that at one point he took a antipsychotic medication that in some cases could be used to treat severe anxiety. And he also took daily medication. And with Nixon, you know, he started when he was vice president under Eisenhower, taking usually three medications daily in order to help his anxiety. And then when he was president, we don't know the full medical record, but we do know that he was taking Valium in 1973, and likely when his full medical record becomes released, probably in a few decades, we'll know the full extent. But based on his medical records as vice president, I wouldn't be surprised if he was taking several medications daily.
We're speaking with Alex Thompson, contributor to Politico magazine. He's also politics and policy editor at Vice News. And he's got an interesting piece that's entitled, "The President Needs a Psychiatrist." All right, so what could it take then? Literally an act of Congress to make this happen?
Yep, that's all it would take. And it's not even like a big act of Congress, and that's why I argue they should do it before the inauguration, because if after the inauguration it will, you know, the politics are tough as it is, but after the inauguration it will be seen as reacting to something that, you know, Mr. Trump is doing. Whereas now, you know, and you know, it doesn't even matter if President Trump wants to see a psychiatrist. The point is that it should be there at all times just in case they need it, because as we've seen, some presidents feel they need it. It's the most stressful job perhaps in the world. world, perhaps in the history of the world. And, you know, the fact that they can't talk to a psychiatrist or, you know, get some anti-anxiety medication just seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah. Jeez, is it that it's been, I don't know, too much of a stigma in the past to, you know, the threat that that could leak, that, you know, maybe the president is unfit?
Exactly. I mean, you know, I talked to David Axelrod, who is Obama's senior advisor, and, you know, he talks about that, you know, if that were to leak, then people would see it through this prism where, you know, maybe if the president was upset, you just wonder, oh, is he having a bad day? You know, did he forget his medication? You know, so some of this is about, you know, the public kind of getting out of the stigma. And, you know, politics is a rough and tumble business. Like, political opponents are going to keep trying to, you know, dig up whatever they can on their opponents. But what I argue is that the presidential psychiatrist actually is the most politically sensitive way to do this, to ensure that a president gets mental health care, because presidential health records are private and they're not FOIA-able. You know, reporters can't request them. And in fact, you could actually maintain a sense of privacy while also ensuring that they get the best care.
What about the idea, perhaps, that Mr. Trump, by taking one on, could set an example, since we're seeing, say, so many soldiers, you know, returning home struggling with things like depression or anxiety or PTSD?
You know, I think that would send a very strong signal, especially as the commander-in-chief, that nobody is above seeing a psychiatrist, because as we've seen with, you know, the rash of veteran suicides and everything, you know, there is like this expectation as a soldier that you are tough, and that, you know, seeing a psychiatrist or being on medication would be a huge weakness and, you know, kind of a defeat for people that are very proud. And I think it would be sending a big signal. He would actually be joining one Democrat in Congress, you know, Ruben Gallego from Arizona, who is an Iraq war veteran and is open about suffering from PTSD.
Thanks, Alex. Alex Thompson, contributing writer to Politico. It's 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. It's not been a period of good news for shopping malls. Both Sears and Macy's have announced they would close stores across the country. Yahoo Finance writer Miles Udland says this makes clear that malls in America, and in particular the anchor stores that brought these malls into existence, are dying. And these closures stand to completely reshape the teenager experience. Miles set this up.
So, if you kind of look at the news flow recently, we had bad news out of Sears, you have bad news from Macy's. Kind of look at all these big box retailers, the anchor stores at your local mall. As their sales get worse, as they talk about moving to an online, you know, they call it omni-channel shopping, right? But it's this combination of in-store and online. They're closing stores in mass, and as these stores close, the viability of your local mall is going to go down. They're going to, you know, close down the anchor store. That's effectively the tenant that's keeping the mall open. And I think as malls, you know, close, you know, we're talking here about the top-level corporate retail side, but I think back to my teenage years, we hung out in malls a lot. You know, wasted time there. It's a free space to loiter.
Right.
You can buy a pretzel at Auntie Anne's for $2, hang out for 3 hours. So I think it's kind of, you know, kind of going beyond just the corporate side and the social challenges perhaps facing, you know, today's 14-year-olds, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I did the same thing and just thought at some point you were God's gift to women and that they would come flocking to you, right? And this would be a great social gathering.
Yeah, if you stand in a group of 10 guys, you know, there's no reason not to go talk to them, right?
That's right. The other thing, too, is, you know, you point that out, you made me think of, like, how about seniors in some of the hot weather states, right, who go there just to maybe get some exercise or cool off?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, my grandparents, they live in New Jersey, and they go to the mall, I guess now they're probably down to twice a week, but when I was younger, it was every day. They went, they just did laps. It was just a thing to do. And I think, you know, as kind of a community space, look, as America got more suburban and the downtown became less of a thing, the mall, in many ways, replaced that sort of communal space where you'd run into people. Again, you know, young people, old people can hang out. It's a place you work. It's a place you shop. And I think as a center of kind of a cultural experience, which doesn't really exist as much in America anymore, I think the mall as an institution, even though it, you know, it kind of represents some of the maybe more consumerist tendencies that people don't like to acknowledge in American culture, I think as a place people hang out and as an idea of sort of what you expect when you think about small town or midtown or big town America, the mall is really going away.
Mm. We're speaking with Miles Udland, markets reporter at Yahoo Finance. He's got an interesting piece entitled "The Death of Malls is Going to Reshape the Teen Experience in America." You know, thinking about this kind of socially also, I almost imagine the mall is like the last stand for teenagers to communicate face-to-face, since we often associate them with their noses in their phones so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I have teenage cousins, and, you know, when they hang out with their friends, that means they agree to go on Xbox Live at the same time and play games communally over the internet instead of actually get together and play games at the same time. Of course, it's more convenient for their parents. They don't have to drive them out of the house. But the social experience has become online, and, you know, I see that with my friends as well. When I was a teenager, it was still kind of hanging out in person. So, you know, I think these are the changes that over the next 10, 20 years we'll begin to see play out. You know, when you have a generation of young people who grew up becoming socialized on GroupMe messages and Snapchat and all this stuff instead of hanging out together, I think the implications will probably be bigger than folks might expect.
Is there no going back at this point, Miles, or are we just not going to see malls come back in the same way that we've known them?
Yeah, I think probably not. Now, it is interesting. At the same time, we're talking about stores like Macy's and Sears closing, you know, hundreds of locations. There was a sort of an overlooked item last week that Amazon is thinking about bidding for the assets of bankrupt American Apparel, which would include their factories and their stores. And I think Amazon, they've opened a couple bookstores. They're certainly interested in the idea that the brick-and-mortar space, maybe it's not a full mall space, but certainly brick-and-mortar shops are still something that the American consumer is looking for. And I think you talk to a lot of people. I certainly do a lot of shopping online, but it is also kind of nice when you go into a place and you get an item right there, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think, you know, the mall as we know it is probably on the way out just because of the macro, you know, commercial real estate trends and all of these other things. But I don't think that brick-and-mortar retail is completely dead in the U.S.
Thanks, Miles. Miles Udland, Yahoo Finance writer. 22 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. How about a co-working space for women only? The co-founder of a place in New York City says she got tired of places where she says she was surrounded by tech guys who interrupt and speak over you. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Where can women hang out and be heard? In a workspace where men aren't allowed. Ann Cadetta, the Wall Street Journal, is here with the story of The Wing, a new women-only social club in New York City. And who's behind this project? How did it get going?
There's two ladies. I think they're both about 29 years old. One is Audrey Gelman. She's the person that I spoke to about the club when I visited. They were both kind of, you know, Manhattan executive types, and they found that oftentimes they'd be going from one place to another. They'd be going from work to dinner or whatever, and they had to change their clothes in a Starbucks bathroom. And then one of them actually was looking in the co-working spaces. It's sort of a way to, you know, kind of have a place to land between errands in the city. And she found that she felt like she was surrounded by men who kind of talked down to her or talked over her. And she thought, wouldn't it be great to have a place in the city where women could come and hang out with each other and work and change their outfits and not feel like it was a big hassle and a rush to sort of get around.
And physically, what does this place look like?
I wrote in my column that it's kind of Barbie meets Bauhaus. It's very kind of contemporary and light. It's in a big penthouse on the top floor of a little office building in the East 20s, and it's very bright, and the furniture is kind of modern and very streamlined, but there's a lot of pink. There's pink couches, and there's pink desk lamps, and there's pink trash cans in the bathrooms, so it's very feminine looking, and I think that was very intentional on their part.
You call this place a workspace, and you mentioned that people went there from in between work and going out to dinner or something. Are people actually working there? What are they doing there?
Yeah, it very much functions as a co-working place, too. I talked to a number of women who come almost every day because they're freelancers and they treat it like their office. I met another woman who works 14 hours a day in her law firm, so she might go to The Wing for a couple hours in the afternoon just to get a break from her own office. I felt really sorry for her. And then some women use it more as a social club, so they have kind of interesting events and classes in the evenings that you can, you know, make pals with other lady folk. And there's also a really nice big locker room and showers and a bathroom where you can, you know, do your makeup and all that kind of thing. So it's really meant for, you know, women professionals who need this kind of space, and there's really nothing else like it in the city right now.
I was going to ask you, you say women professionals, is it geared toward any particular age group?
They want to be very inclusive, and I believe about 20% of their membership is over 50. Both the founders are, like I said, in their late 20s, and I think because of that, it skews pretty young. When I was there, it seemed like almost everybody was in their late 20s or early 30s. There were a couple of ladies in their 40s and 50s. I do believe that they are trying, or they're hoping to make it a little more inclusive and less skewed toward younger people.
Do you think then there will be more such clubs?
They are definitely planning on it, both in New York City, and I think they'd like to open in other cities as well.
And what about the people who say this is reverse discrimination, or it's not okay to have men-only clubs? Why is it okay to have a women-only club?
Well, it definitely is discrimination. I don't think anyone's disputing that. You know, I talked to the founders, and I'm like, well, what about men-only clubs? And they're like, I think that's great. And I talked to some of the members, and I'm like, what about men-only clubs? And they're like, men should have their own space, too. No one seems to have any problem with that. And discrimination is entirely legal as long as it's a private members-only club. So you can pretty much do whatever you want as long as you're not saying that your venue is open to the public.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Ann Cadet at the Wall Street Journal. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, breaking free from your computer operating system. The least stressful jobs in America. And the t-shirts empowering cancer patients. That story in about 20 minutes. The Department of Veterans Affairs acknowledges its role in creating a large population of opioid-addicted veterans by over-prescribing painkillers for injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. After the agency tightened prescribing practices in 2013, many veterans bought pain pills sold illicitly on the streets. When those became too expensive, they sought heroin and fentanyl, a potent synthetic narcotic. Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borlein says the VA is now struggling to undo the damage. Valerie, why was the VA prescribing so many painkillers?
Well, in fairness to the VA, everyone was, right? I mean, in the mid-2000s, there was an incredible push to treat pain as the fifth vital sign, to treat pain as like you would a fever, and to alleviate it. And there were these powerful drugs that came on the market. And at the same time, the United States was at war for a number of years and had a lot of very seriously injured soldiers. So it was, in a sense, a perfect storm. The VA was prescribing opioids in massive numbers to help treat pain, but didn't fully realize at the time the danger of these drugs.
What's happening now to the vets who are taking this stuff?
Well, many of them have been on these strong narcotics for many years, and they have physical addictions to them. And as the VA has started to taper the use of these drugs and try to get them on smaller dosages, there are many, many thousands of vets who have turned to the streets, we're told, and are buying pills either from other vets or on the street, or even when that fails, buying heroin, which is almost is a chemical cousin of these pills.
What's the scope of this problem?
You know, it's sobering numbers, actually. There are about 30,000 veterans treated by the VA in 2006 for opioid use disorder, and many of those would have been holdovers, for example, from the Vietnam War, who had heroin or morphine problems. And today, there's 66,000 treated so far this year. So 30,000 to 66,000 in 10 years is a significant scope. And I should point out, the VA doesn't treat treats a portion of the veterans in this country, but by no means all of them. So we really don't know the full scope of the issue.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borlein. Her story is called "The VA Hooked Veterans on Opioids, Then Failed Them Again." What's the VA doing to help them, and what are they not doing, Valerie?
Well, to their credit, they are cutting back on their prescribing. They've cut back a third in these high-dose opioids and as well as long-term dosages. And that's a big step. And they're trying to get their systems to talk with each other and with state prescription drug registries a little bit better so they can know if a person is getting pills outside of VA in a private practice, for example. So they're doing those things kind of on the supply side. And then they're also trying to transition veterans to other types of pain management, whether that's acupuncture or yoga or other types of things. And they're trying to get more treatment resources. It's just a very slow process to build up that kind of robust treatment operation. And a lot of civilian healthcare systems are also struggling with this epidemic nationally.
So what are some of the worst case scenarios that you've heard?
It's just a story that you hear many times. And I've gotten so many emails from people saying, this happened to my cousin or this happened to my friend or my son. So a common story is just someone got hurt during training, or someone got hurt when an IED or bomb exploded and started taking pills on a temporary short-term basis, and then just kept taking them because it helped them keep going. It helped them maybe get redeployed, and that habit just carried on past the years, and it can end up really wreaking havoc on people's lives, their marriages, their families, their careers.
Thanks, Valerie. Wall Street Journal reporter Valerie Borlein. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Glad you're with us. If you upgraded your computer over the holidays and also are thinking of upgrading your operating system, you might be tempted to go with open source software like Linux. But consumer advocate Chris Elliott says it's not an easy path. He just did it. He says while open source software may represent the future of computer operating systems, it is a distant future for many of us. Chris, what'd you look at?
Well, I looked at the two dominant operating systems, which are, of course, the Microsoft Windows operating system and Apple's OS, and found a lot of frustration. People who were upset, for example, one reader was talking about how he was really tired of these forced upgrades that stopped his work during the middle of the day, and also just the overall look and feel, the sluggishness of his computer after each update. And so he was looking for something else, maybe something that was more open source, which is what a lot of things are moving towards these days, and found something very interesting.
All right, so what is it? What's the open source is what?
Open source is actually the Linux operating system, and it comes in several different flavors. He used a variety called Ubuntu, which you can download for free. And I should say that this is not something for the faint of heart. You need to back up your systems if you do this, and you need to have some gadget know-how before you try it. But it's really got a lot of potential, and I think in a couple of years, we might see more people moving toward these open source, they don't cost anything, operating systems.
So how complicated is it? This sounds like something that I would wind up pulling my hair out if I were to try it.
Yeah, I tried it, and I kind of was pulling my hair out as well. I did it on my Mac. I have a 2012 MacBook Pro, and I got really frustrated because the fan started running all the time, and I was looking for something that was a little bit lighter, less clunky. Every time it seemed that the Apple updated my operating system, it got slower and slower. And so what I did was I backed everything up, and then I installed a variety of Linux called Fedora. And it's really easy to download Fedora. The problem is the drivers. And this is why, Linux is probably not quite ready for prime time yet. It's that you have to get into the weeds a little bit with drivers and line commands. So you have to have some gadget know-how. But once I got it working, it was great. I mean, it was fast. The interface was really easy to use. And I just think that there's a lot of potential down the road for other people to say, look, I'm done with all of these forced upgrades and this proprietary operating system.
I'm moving to Linux.
So do you think that Microsoft and Apple have been put on notice, or is it too soon to say that?
I certainly hope so. I mean, if you're, I don't know if you're a Windows or a Mac user. Most people actually are on Windows, so they're used to these upgrades that come in all the time and basically stop everything.
Yeah.
And they're also used to the performance issues with Windows, which is that, you know, you might have a good version of Windows that comes out, but then the next one maybe isn't so good. And they're looking for more consistency. And I think that an operating system like Linux can deliver that consistency over time. We just have to wait and see.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Elliott, consumer advocate. 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you could be with us. Got a young adult in the house looking for a career path. CareerCast.com is out with a list of the least stressful jobs for 2017. Here's online content editor Kyle Kensing. Kyle, what did the research turn up?
Yeah, so with least stressful, I mean, I think it's important to note that any job is going to face stresses. But when you look at the full 200 that we research for our jobs rated report, and with stress in particular, we always try to look at 11 criteria. Those are how much are you traveling? What's the growth potential, both in your career and your income? What are the physical demands, environmental conditions, potential hazards you might see, meeting the public, competition within the field or for positions in the field? The risk of yourself or another suffering death or grievous injury, deadlines, and then working in the public eye. So looking at those 11 factors, while any of these jobs is going to have stress, they're not going to have stress at the same degree as the other jobs that we track for our jobs rated report.
All right, so what made the list? Give us a couple here.
So number one is diagnostic medical sonographer, and that's a very important job. You know, obviously, if you have a pregnant wife or pregnant yourself or yourself or a muscle tear, a sonographer is very important. But that's a job where you're working in a safe environment. It's an office environment, and it's got great growth potential and income potential. And you're not necessarily in any sort of physical harm, and the deadlines are a little bit different than something like a newspaper reporter. So that's the number one job for this year. And actually, that's kind of a bit of a trend where you do see a lot of jobs that are either in healthcare or you're working in an office environment, IT, those sort of things. Those are pretty predominant here on our top 10.
Wow. All right. What else is on the list?
Well, going back to healthcare, you've got a medical laboratory technician. So somebody who's working in a lab, you've got great growth outlook, high potential for your pay. And again, you're working in that safer kind of lab environment. And then a pharmacy technician in the same vein, and then a medical records tech, which is a pretty high growth field. And that's an interesting one that makes a lot of our best jobs list because it's one that's got great potential as far as getting started in the field, and it's going to be really in demand, especially as healthcare practitioners move more and more towards online, or not online, but cloud-based file storage.
We're speaking with Kyle Kensing, online content editor at CareerCast.com. They've got some new research out identifying the least stressful jobs of 2017. All right, looks like a lot of people lining up to be a tenured university professor, number five on the list of least stressful. 13% growth outlook and a pretty good salary at $72,000.
Yeah, with university professor, you know, that's one that sometimes gets a little bit of pushback when it makes this least stressful list, in part because getting those tenure track jobs can be very competitive. And with our growth outlook, we're focused on all university professorships. So that would include adjunct and people just getting started, you know, on that tenure track. But once you're on that tenure track, you know, it's a great position to have. You're having a lot of really positive impact, and you're in that safe environment of, you know, a university campus with students who want to be there and want to get started on their careers.
How come nobody wants to be a jeweler anymore, apparently?
Yeah, that's one that also made our endangered list that we put out recently. And that's interesting with the drop in the growth outlook, you know, because potential with a career growth is one of the factors that we look at. So that did ding it. But overall, in terms of being a least stressful, when you're in that workshop kind of environment, you know, you're not facing physical hazards. But the growth outlook for that one is negatively impacted by consolidation of companies and outsourcing to the manufacturing position.
Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Kensing from CareerCast.com. It's 7 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. And by the way, a reminder, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. We use the username at This Morning Show. You can follow me directly on Twitter as well with the username at Gordon Deal. Well, here's a guy who's good at creating slogans, turning his clever phrases into a nonprofit. His name is Dan Dickinson, and he's a cancer survivor So he's aware that support and having a positive attitude are key ingredients to beating it. USA Today says Mr. Dickinson has raised over $2,000 for cancer-fighting shirts for hope. The T-shirts have funny messages designed to inspire, like cancer's worst nightmare or too sexy for cancer. The idea came to him when he was in the midst of his own chemotherapy treatment. He was attending a cardio class to decrease the side effects of chemotherapy, and he was doing so well in the class that the instructor suggested that he make T-shirts. Mr. Dickinson took it a step further by making the letters look like a 1950s monster horror movie when it was suggested that he was cancer's worst nightmare. Armed with the T-shirts, he and his team of volunteers, many of them also survivors, spend time at local cancer treatment hospitals, visiting patients, handing out shirts, and of course offering advice and sharing some laughs. Mr. Dickinson says the goal is to spend some time with each fighter to list, to encourage, to inspire, to give hope. Story coming out of Kansas City, Missouri. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.